hands up. This is your opportunity to ask any of the questions that you want to know about the history of the program, about Bob personally, about anything you want to ask him. If he'll just talk on any subject you want to ask him, except if it fits with program and he prefers history, because he's the one who knows about that. Now, I'm sure that several of you have questions. Some of you have told me that you did. Here's how Bob likes to do this. Especially since we're going to be recording this for other people's arrangements as time goes by. Instead of spending the time walking up here to the microphone to ask your questions, when you have questions, you just sort of line up here, and then as one person gets up to ask the question, move on down, and another person will take the seat on the end so that you'll be very close to the microphone, which makes Charlie happy back there. And you're willing to do that. Okay, the first one, if you have a question, come on up and sit down here now. You're going to let Bob talk for the whole hour?
Yeah.
How can he answer questions if you don't have questions to ask him? Somebody has questions about Ann, his mother, wanted him to talk about that. So as you have them, just Tommy will have one, and he'll come up here and sit right here. There you go. And Hank will have a question. Look at these
great.
Okay, that's the idea. And Bob will talk a little while, and then Tommy will come up and ask his question. So, with no further ado, I'm going to do it.
We could. If Tom and I are going to call you after you. Hey, Jay, get up here. You've been talking all morning.
Come on down. Okay, so if you'll just do that, then Bob will begin. And, okay, Charlie, I guess we are ready to roll.
I just wanted to charge Charlie's battery a little to get him started. Thank you for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here with all you guys. I look at the retreat as a wonderful thing. There's a firm called Sumitanga. I don't know if you've ever heard it or not. Everything that's carried up through the Himalaya Mountains is carried on human being backs. At the start of the journey, they very carefully strap them all on so that they won't chafe and won't wear and won't slip. And periodically, as they climb the heights of the Himalayas, there's a resting place, and there is what they call a Sumitanga. A Sumitanga is just a ledge carved in the rock whereby these people who are carrying all this burden can back up to it, rest the burden. Not take it off, just rest it on the shelf, the Sumitanga, until they can get their strength to go on. And I think maybe that's one of the things that we are going to do here. We have our own Sumitanga, a chance to rest perhaps our load while we are free of it, and we can all be together. I look at all of us who come to these things as a seeker. I think we want to learn more and more about our program. think we want to learn more and more about the spiritual part of the program, and I want to say right from the word go, if you don't have a spiritual part, you haven't got a program. I can promise you that. This program is spiritual. I'm the only one still living that was present when the two co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous met for the very first time, Akron, Ohio, Mother's Day, 1935. And I rode out with my dad and mom to meet with Bill at the home of Henrietta Cyberly. And if I may, I'd love to take you back in that period of history. My dad had come home the day before Mother's Day with a potted plant. He was potted. Set it down, went upstairs and passed out. Mom was a friend of Henrietta, said, Henrietta called and said, Ann, there's a man out here that thinks he can help Bob, bring him right on out. Well, Mom had to explain to Henrietta that Bob was in no shape to talk to anybody, but she said, I'll get him out there the next day. Well, as we rode along, he had an awful hangover. He said, one of the worst he'd ever had. And he said, okay, 15 minutes of this bird is all I want. But thank goodness it wasn't 15 minutes. He and Bill went off the room, they talked for many hours. And as a result of that meeting and then my mom's invitation, Mom invited Bill to come and live with us. Actually move in and live with us. And I think that's another little miracle. And I'll tell you something else. Remember, Bill lived in New York City. We lived in Akron, huh? Bill said, okay. And so he moved in to our home and stayed all that summer. And I was a teenager at the time, and I was kind of old enough to know what was going on. These two guys couldn't raise $50 between them. But they had two things going for them that I could see. They both had open spiritual minds, and they had the desire to be of service to another human being. I want to tell you about my dad. Every time I look at his picture in an AA clubhouse, he looks just grim and bad, and I want to dispel that. He was a happy guy. I'll give you, for instance, one time, he had some sort of an old car and it wouldn't run very well, and used a lot of gasoline, and he wanted to go back to his native Vermont and then tour up into Canada in the Laurentian Park. And I had a Model A Ford Roadster that I had bought for less than $30. Now, the reason it was so cheap was I didn't get the top. I said, he said, you think that little thing around in Vermont and up in Canada? I said, yeah, Russ, good, Dad. But I said, the reason it was so cheap that I don't have the top. I said, what are we going to do when it rains? He said, we're going to get wet. And he and another high school buddy of mine toured in this old Ford Roadster, and they just had the best time. He was a great sport. He loved jokes. The elevator girls and the nurses saved their jokes, and they'd bring them home and try them on me. A great sense of humor. When I bought my bride-to-be home in the 1940s, my wife was tall and slender, and Dad looked her over, and he said, she's built for speed and light housekeeping. And I'll tell you about his sex and hygiene lecture to me as a teenager. He got me up the bathroom one day, and I thought, I'm going to find out all about it now. Closed the door, and he said to me, flies spread disease. Keep yours buttoned. He was a tall, thin Vermonter with icy blue eyes. He kind of could look right through you. Bill was also a tall, thin Vermonter, born within 100 miles of each other. And when these two guys got moving a little bit down there in Akron, the rumor went out that this was a bunch of those Vermont Yankees set down to feel us Midwesterners. lady had just been thrown out of his house for not paying rent. Remember, this is in the middle of the last Great Depression. Nobody had any money. And again, I think providentially arranged because people had time for each other. But there were tier after tier of repoed cars in the downtown garages. Strong men on the street corner selling apples for 5 cents a piece. That's how bad times were. One industry town, Akron, Ohio, we made tires. Goodyear, Goodrich, General, Firestone, Sarberly, Miller. All of the tire manufacturers were there. People stopped buying tires. They didn't need them. They didn't have a car. So the town fell flat on its face economically. And I think that, again, this was absolutely necessary because people had time to communicate with each other. Well, he'd just been thrown out of his house for non-payment rent along with a pretty little blonde wife and two stair-step kids. So they moved the whole family into our house. We still had a house, barely. Remember, President Roosevelt had declared a mortgage moratorium whereby people were allowed to stay in the home and they couldn't keep up with the payments anymore. So that's the only reason we had a house. But anyway, took Eddie upstairs, locked him in the upstairs, where Eddie'd be available as they got this knowledge. You gotta remember, nothing's written. They're just trying to stay a page ahead of Eddie. And Eddie was an agile young guy, and we had downspouts. And Eddie would open the second story window, slide down the downspouts, and escape. And they'd have to postpone Eddie's recovery long enough to recapture him. One time Eddie got as far away as Cleveland, 35 miles away, called them up on the phone, collect, to let them know that he was going to commit suicide. But that he would give them time to drive up and witness the event. Rescued Eddie one more time, but when Eddie sobered up, he had a few other problems that had surfaced. He began beating up on this little woman to whom he was married. Then he began chasing my mom around the house with a butcher knife. We held a group conscience meeting, and it was decided the only thing to do with Eddie was for his little wife to take him back to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and recommit him in a mental institution, and this was done. And Bill and Dad were crestfallen. Here's their first attempt to sober up another alcoholic. Total failure. 15 years later, at my dad's funeral, a man walked up to me, and he said, "Do you know me?" And I looked at him, and I said, "Yeah, I know you, you're Eddie." And he said, "That's right." And he said, "I want you to know I'm a member of the Youngstown, Ohio AA group, and I've been sober 1 year." So we don't know the result of that 12-step call. Our part is to take that hand that reaches up for the help. That's our part of it. We're not responsible for the results. We're responsible to give our help to the person who asked for it, to make that 12-step call. And I don't think you have to be completely qualified to make a 12-step call. I think you got to go with what you've got. That's all that's required. Go with what you have at the moment. Well, Dad was a graduate of Dartmouth, one of the Ivy League colleges back in the East, the Drinkers Ivy League College, and he fit right in there. And last month, Lamona and I were invited to come up to Dartmouth they wanted to make some special awards to my dad, Dr. Bob Smith, as their most famous alumni. Now, I can assure you he wasn't the most famous student, but now he's in their good favor, and they went up there and they were making some very, very nice presentations. They're very proud of Dr. Bob right now. After he graduated from Dartmouth, he worked out in industry for a while. He went down to Boston, and years. And I've talked to some of you about it. I think this is when he decided he must have got drunk and got tattooed. He had a dragon that started in his left shoulder and went round and round and out his wrist, and it was blue with red fire. And I said, "Dad, how in the world did you ever get that?" He said, "Boy, that was a dandy." He had to be drunk for a week to get that thing. That hurts. But anyhow, he went back to his native Vermont, prevailed upon his dad, who was a probate judge up there, to send him out to Chicago and allow him to go to medical school. He busted out of the first one because of his drinking. But Fanny managed to graduate from the second one and moved to Akron, Ohio. He obtained a coveted internship there at City Hospital in Akron. It was coveted because they had some advanced equipment. And he moved to Akron and married my mom after a whirlwind courtship of only 17 years. Dr. Bob thought things over very carefully. He really was a man of few words. Now, Bill, you understand, was also a native Vermonter. Tall, thin, total, absolute opposite. Some of you may have known Bill. Bill was a promoter. Bill was a salesman. Bill was a visionary. I think Bill Wilson could see further up the road ahead than any human I've ever known in my life. Bill moved swung. He was either high as a Georgia pine or low as a snake. He suffered long periods of depression. Dr. Bob went along pretty much on an even keel. These two guys fit together perfectly. They never had an argument. And again, I think that was providentially arranged because, you know, if any two of us are exactly alike, one of us is unnecessary. Anyway, they both had open spiritual minds and a desire to be of service to another human being. I want to tell you about somebody nobody knows anything about, and I think maybe she wanted it that way, and I never could understand it completely, but I do now. My mom. Mom was a graduate of Wellesley, one of the fine women's colleges back in the East, and she went there on a scholarship. And Mom's great-uncle was the president of the Santa Fe Railroad. At that time, the railroad president had his own private rail cars, could tie on the trains wherever trains went. And he liked my mom and would take her with him on some of these trips, so she got to see the opulent and the genteel side of life. And Mom was a school teacher, and she led a very sheltered, protected life and was very easily shocked until AA. But remember, Mom was the one that invited Bill to come and live with us. Mom was the one that we began taking these people into our home. Nobody had any money. Hospital beds were very expensive in those days. A double was $16. I think they're up a little now, but nobody had any money. So we began taking these alcoholics into our home. And now Mom's the one that's making the beds. Mom's the one that's cooking the food. Mom's the one that's on the telephone. Mom's the one that insisted everybody that stayed there have a quiet time in the morning, and they had a reading of the Bible and a time to meditate. So every morning, that was one of Mom's rules. Mom was the one that endured the snubs. You see, we weren't very popular with the neighbors. If you're going to get a feel for that, start a halfway house of your own. The neighbors didn't like us at all. In fact, we even got kicked out of the Presbyterian Church on account of AA. Now, I never heard of anybody getting kicked out of the Presbyterian Church, but we were. The minister said that the group was disturbing the organization. So it wasn't an easy, easy thing for her, but she never lost faith in these guys. Now, Dan went off to a medical meeting in Atlanta, Atlantic City and came back roaring drunk. Now, Bill was there at this time and checked in, called his office nurse and her husband. They came and got him and took him up to their house and sobered him up because he didn't want to come home. And Bill was ready. Bill had his bags packed and was ready to leave, and Mom begged him to stay. Please, Bill, let's try one more time. And thank goodness he stayed. Thank goodness he stayed, because after my dad sobered up on that one, he never ever took another drink as long as he lived. AA was not an instant success. It was thought of as a cult and a bunch of nuts. Dad, in the meanwhile, he had, with the perfect alcoholic timing, in 1929 he went back to Rochester, Minnesota and studied under the Mayo brothers to become a specialist. Well, 1929 came the crash, and stock market crash, and that's when the bottom just fell out of everything. So he shows up, he's back in Akron with a brand new practice. He's a surgeon now, and his new practice depends on references from other doctors, and they all knew he was an alcoholic. So we had no money, just no money. If Mom had $2 for groceries, it was a bonanza day for us. That's how close it was. But the thing, the little thing began to prosper. The trickle of people came in, you know. And then the media got a hold of it. First the Cleveland Plate Dealer, then Jack Alexander's famous article in the Saturday Evening Post. And the little trickle became an absolute deluge. I mean, the word got out that there was a doctor in Akron, Ohio, could quote pitch drunks. And they came out on a bus and on a train, dropped off by loving relatives. Dropped off by relatives who weren't so loving. But again, our Heavenly Father provided the right person. Sister Ignatia. Sister was the admitting nurse at a Catholic hospital there in Akron. And she and my dad prevailed upon the Mother Superior to allow them to have a little alcoholic ward in that hospital whereby people could be admitted with the disease of alcoholism for the first time. You see, before then they had been admitting them under guise, gastroenteritis, whatever they could get them in with. Now you could be admitted to a hospital with the disease of alcoholism. The first ward was in the flower room of this Catholic hospital. And in those days, it was a requirement that they take all the flowers out of the patient's room and store them in the flower room at night because of the oxygen transfer and so forth. So I've often wondered what the early alcoholics thought when they came to and looked around. They got a room full of flowers. Must have been quite a jolt, don't you imagine? But anyway, that ward is still in that hospital. It's not the flower room. It takes a whole pit floor. They didn't continue this operation ever since. In 1942, AA started to self-destruct. His contributions to the New York office dropped off to nothing. There were people hanging out their shingles as AA's official representative. There were people incorporating Alcoholics Anonymous in their own state. There were people establishing hospitals, treatment hospitals, as official AA. And a guy from New York, North Carolina, wrote to Bill and said, Bill, we got to do something. So we're going to be like the Washingtonians. Well, 160 years ago, there was an outfit called the Washington Temper Society, started by six alcoholics from Baltimore. And they had the desire of total abstinence. They traveled to each other's meetings. They did a lot of things that we do today. They did not have the anonymity, but the people, they had their people sign a pledge that they weren't going to drink it. And it grew 10 times as fast as AA. I thought both showed that there was a quarter of a million of them in Ohio alone. Well, what happened to the Washingtonians was they got to thinking that this is so good for alcoholism. It's good for everything. They got into politics. They got into money issues. They got into all sorts of social issues, and in 6 years, it was gone. It just blew apart. And I'll tell you how far gone it was. Bill had to go to the public library there in New York City and find out who the Washingtonians were. So that's another thing that we have been able to do is protect our primary purpose, and that's to help the alcoholic stop drinking. Been a spiritual program. Did you ever wonder where they got the info to work on this? Okay, think about this now. Bill in New York City belonged to an organization called the Oxford Group. At the same time, my parents in Akron, Ohio belonged to the Oxford Group. This is before they ever met, even knew each other, even existed. But they both had that background, which has stood us in good stead. We owe those people a tremendous debt of gratitude. The Oxford Group was started by a Lutheran minister from Pennsylvania by the name of Frank Bookman, and the basic principles were back to first century spirituality. They shared with each other, they had the meetings, they got guidance for each other, they did many, many things that we still use. They had the four absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness, absolute purity of thought, and absolute love. Those things have been woven into our program. So, and if you ever have the time, pick up the book on What is the Oxford Group, and you will see the many, many things that we use were actually based by the Oxford Group. I used to go to a few of those meetings with my parents. I think to get out of the doghouse, you never suspect it now, but I was not a constant source of joy to my parents. But they were zealous. They scared me to death. In your face, you know. Are you maximum today? Well, I was just barely minimum, you know. They worried me, but anyhow, we owe those people a tremendous debt of gratitude, and it was inevitable that we part, because, see, the Oxford Group wanted to cater to the upper middle class, and the early alcoholics were not upper middle class. The Oxford Group wanted publicity, and the alcoholics already had all the publicity they wanted. And another thing they had a form of an open confession or a fifth step. They would take a new guy upstairs in one of the rooms at T. Henry Williams' house and bore in on it till he admitted what his problem was. Well, you see, that was open confession and was not acceptable to people of the Catholic faith. And I don't know whether you guys realize it or not, but there are Catholics that drink too much. But anyhow, it was inevitable that they part. In 1950, you see what happened when AA starts self-destruct. They wrote the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bill went around the country in the late 40s trying to interest groups in the 12 traditions that grew for then like they are now. They said, Bill, go on back to New York, run that like you want to. We'll run this here. And they wouldn't pay attention to it. So they held the first international in Cleveland, Ohio, 1950, and I was there. My dad was terminally ill and he gave his last talk. Dad very seldom ever led a meeting. There's only two recorded talks. That was on my dad. He was not the speaker type. He sat in the back of the room and listened. But anyhow, he gave a short talk. Six guys got up and read two traditions each. They adopted them unanimously. And what a blessing that is. The longer I'm around the program, the more I appreciate those traditions. This is the glue that holds us together, folks. This is the glue that holds us together. And also, look at them the next time from this standpoint. They are a fantastic job of damage control. They are a fantastic job of damage control, anticipating the things with the little medallion-looking thing like this that she would give them and say, "Now this is yours to keep." But he said, "If you just before you take a drink, I want you to bring this back and give it to me. Give it back to me." Neat idea of hers. Okay.
Well, many of us believe that Alcoholics Anonymous was divinely inspired, and we continue to believe that and realize that higher power did bring it to order. So there's a couple things I'd like to ask you about, Bob, and appreciate you being here. One is, what was the kind of discussion that led to the requirement for membership, only a desire to stop drinking? It's so unique that there must be some background to that. The second is, looking at dissension and disagreements and personality issues that separate and tear up institutions and organizations. In AA, it works the reverse. If we disagree, you go form your own group and you follow the rules.
Yeah.
And AA grows with dissension. I just wondered if you could, if there was any discussion you recall about those issues.
Well, of course, AA was never had any big arguments and so forth. Not much they did. They fought like dogs. Did you ever know Bill Dodson, AA number 3 stories not in the first edition of the big book? I wonder why? Bill wanted to get paid for it. It's not in there either. It didn't appear until later on. Oh, there's all sorts of fights over stuff, but it was kind of a crucible, you know, that brought us all together. The fact that they could survive the arguments, to survive the fights, and again, I think that is a result of group conscience, don't you guys? I mean, it seems like there's a big battle going. If you put it in front of the group conscience, they'll come up with the right answer. It's always been amazing to me how well that works. The group conscience will finally settle it in a way that should have been done. Was there something else you
inquired with your membership?
Oh, okay. When a first was written, it said the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. And they got to thinking about that, and they thought, nobody ever got here with an honest desire to do anything. So they struck that out. Then they thought, well, maybe it ought to read, the only requirement for membership is a sincere desire to stop drinking. And they studied on that one for a while. They didn't figure anybody got here with any kind of a sincere idea to do anything. So they struck that out. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, the way it reached now. There were some other changes. He used to read ugly on our knees. And they struck that on our knees out. Okay.
Bob, I'd like to thank you very much for coming down
down here this weekend and wonderful sharing with us. In all my reading, I've never heard about your mom talking Bill into staying at that last
night. Oh, yeah.
And I, as I said, there chills went up down my spine, thinking, what if she hadn't done that? Every man in this room would not be here. But one of the things I'd like you to kind of clarify in my mind is, my understanding was in the early days, everybody in the meetings used first and last names, even though there was some anonymity later on outside. But in the early days, everybody actually used both first and last names. And also, if you would reflect a little bit on the meditation, I understand that you talked about that meditation that they did. Did they actually have a group meeting in your house? And did your mom make everybody come down and kind of reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Everybody that was staying there, when she had her meditation meeting, everybody attended. That was a requirement. She wasn't going to let you get by without that one. And again, I think it was very beneficial because, you know, it says, sought through prayer and meditation. And a lot of us have, including me, have problems with the meditation part. And I think that that's one thing that we are building here is the ability to meditate with God. And the other part was, tell me.
In the meeting, did everybody use full names?
Oh, okay, yeah. I remember they jumped my father out about that. And here's what he said. He said, I think that anyone that can read and understand the English language will understand what it's supposed to be. Anonymity through what?
Press radio.
Press radio bill. There are some people who want to protect their anonymity. Maybe I could see reasons why they would. That's fine with me. But I think the longer you're around, the less important it becomes. But the beautiful part of anonymity is that you can't be Mr. AA or Mrs. Al-Anon if nobody knows what your name is outside. And another thing that anonymity has done, that makes us all exactly alike. Doesn't make any difference. You've been here 40 days or 40 years. We're all exactly the same. And isn't that the way it should be? Okay.
My question is, you being the first child in a recovering family, now, how did you deal with all these drunks coming to your home and taking your parents? Now, apparently you turned out okay, but was there some rough times for you? I even feel bad, hitting my sponsor's house as much as I do, but, what was your take on all this in the beginning and how you coped with it?
Oh, wow, I love to talk. This was recovery. For 17 years of my life, I lived in a home with active alcoholism. Any of you lived in a home with active alcoholism, raise your hand. Okay. I think we get to adulthood with some scars. I don't doubt that for a minute. But what I personally have to avoid is not allowing myself to sink into the victim mindset. That because I was raised in a home with active alcoholism, all the screw-ups I do, all the bad things I do, all the things I'm supposed to do and didn't do, they're not my fault. I'm a victim. And you know how we love being victims in this country now. But the thing that I must remember, and I speak only for myself, is if I adopt that victim mindset, it works. But
fuel. That's the upfront price that you pay for that particular thing. And so I want to look at myself as not as a victim, but as a survivor. Now, when they started bringing these guys, you remember my sister and I are teenagers. You remember how you love action when you're a teenager? Boy, they were squirting out all over the place, you know, and just, it was always something going on, and it was fun. It was plus the fact it was recovery. We'd see these guys come in and with the blank eyes, you know, and there's nothing. And pretty soon there's a little bit of sparkle, and pretty soon you've got a viable human being on your hands. And these weren't just overnight kids. Old Arch T, who started AA in Detroit, stayed almost a year. But my sister and I went away. Dad would, he had a little way of handling him. He would give him a shot of whiskey if they would take this medicine first. It was Peraldehyde. Yeah, see, if any of you have ever smelled Peraldehyde, you know it's a very pungent sedative. And so as Susie and I opened the front door from school and smelled Peraldehyde, we knew we'd lost our bed. I went to the attic and Susie went to the couch. But we didn't mind. This was recovery. Okay.
Bob, I too was unaware of the fact that Bill had spent that first summer in your home. And my question was, I assume that Lois did not and was in New York, but what was the how good of a relationship and what kind of a relationship did Lois and your mother have? And then after your father died, how supportive was Bill and Lois of your mother?
Okay. They had a good relationship. Mom wrote to Lois that first summer. And, you know, Lois in New York, we were in Akron, and Lois came down and spent as much time with us as she possibly could. But then Lois had to go back to New York. You got to remember, Lois is the only one that had a job. But it was the start of a friendship that lasted until Lois's death. Bill was always good to us, too. You know, he invited us to the Second International in 1955. So, and we visited Stepping Stones at various times. So, we had a good relationship with Lois. My mom had a good relationship with Lois. It was just, and we used to go to New York City periodically. Yeah, I've even been in the old Dr. Burnham's house there in Brooklyn where Lois and Bill lived till Dr. Burnham sold the place and left them homeless. But she was always kind and good and sweet. My mom thought the world of Lois and Lois thought the world of Mom. But I want to tell you something else. In the early part of 1936, Mom started a group for the wives of alcoholics in 1936, whereby she tried to teach them love and tolerance and so forth. Well, in 1950, when Lois and Ann B., not my mom, but Ann B., decided to see if there was an interest in a program like Al-Anon, they wrote to all the known AA groups around the country. And to their surprise, they found out there were 64 groups already doing it. Independent thinking had figured out it was a family issue and they were handling it as best they could. So right from the word go, first for my mom and then through the Al-Anon program, we've had a wonderful relationship. Guys, you got to remember, Al-Anon does not have a program. That may come as a shock to you. The program we had was a gift. Pure, out-and-out gift from Alcoholics Anonymous. That's our program. That's it. It was a gift from AA.
Question that I have, and correct me if I'm wrong,
understand it, and I guess it was at Charles House, that Bill was kept a bottle of liquor upon the counter. And was there some people that didn't want that? And how did they get through that? My question.
Yeah, Bill insisted that Mom keep a bottle of liquor up over the sink. Scared Mom to death, you know, worried her to death, but she went along with it, and as far as I know, nobody ever bothered that bottle of liquor, but that was one of the things that Bill wanted done, and it was done. It was kept there.
I have two questions. One was, you know, I heard when we started with the Serenity Prayer. And when was that actually adapted as part of the program? And that might be just something I haven't read yet. But the other part was, I've heard so much about Clarence Snyder in different parts of the incident. And when the traditions came about, that he didn't agree to them.
Right.
And that was part of the breakup of the group that he was in. So.
Okay, the Serenity Prayer was not written by AA. I think you understand that. In fact, we recite only the first little part of it. It was written by, I never can pronounce the guy's name, but he was not AA, but AA has been allowed to use that first part that we use in our program. I read a book about Clarence just on the way down here, and I knew Clarence, of course. I knew Bill Dodson, the number three. He was my lawyer. But Clarence was a real brash guy. And when I took my wife to her first AA conference, she's newly sober, and Clarence was one of the speakers. Clarence called up the Wichita, Kansas paper and said, "I'm Clarence Snyder, the founder of AA." And they showed up with it, took his picture. He appeared on the radio and on the TV if they'd have him. No anonymity whatsoever. Well, what actually he was saying, he worded it very, very carefully. But if you listen very carefully, what he was saying that was, he was the founder of the first group to use the name of Alcoholics Anonymous in Cleveland. And that's absolutely true. He was not a founder of the program, but he was the founder of that group. But he worded it very carefully. And of course, when he came out with this, all this announcement and no anonymity, the young people were shocked and the old people said, "Who is this nut?" And you see, now Clarence came into the program in 1938. There wasn't any anonymity in 1938. Clarence figured he grandfathered in, and he never did respect anonymity either. He just grandfathered into it. So Lois wrote him one time, and he just announced that he wasn't going to do it, and never did. But Clarence did an awful lot of good. He was... Clarence loved my dad, and he hated Bill. He made Bill's life miserable, wrote him hot letters, just all sorts of things. I don't know why, but anyway, he loved Dr. Bob and he hated Bill. That's the way Clarence was. In his later life, he has some spiritual retreats, one down in Florida and one up in the north someplace. And I went to one of them. This is after Clarence died, but it was run by his widow, who then was the Amazing Grace. And they were very, very, very spiritual up front. And he was very, very spiritually oriented. But he never was anonymous, I'll tell you.
I went to treatment in Jacksonville, Florida, and when I first came in there, you know, we were all in haste the first day. And they showed us a film called My Name is Bill W., which James Garnett picked your father. Is that movie pretty much, they also showed it nationwide on national television one time. Is that pretty much too what happened, or is that a lot of that just not what happened?
I thought that was a great movie. I really did. I thought that was a great movie. They handled it beautifully at the time that they were allotted. Well, if you checked down below, you said there was a Garner Duschau production. Okay, you know who James Garner is. Peter Duschau was a California AA, 28 years sober when the thing was produced. And I got to tell you this, he called me up for some input into what they were doing. A typical California AA, and never got to say a word. Spiritual, and this is a wonderful place to renew your spirituality.